Welcome to Mike Drop Market Spaces today. Just as a reminder, before we begin, this material is presented solely for informational and entertainment purposes only and is not to be construed as a recommendation, solicitation, or an offer to buy or sell, long or short, any securities, commodities, or any related financial instruments. As always, please contact a licensed professional before making any investment or trading decisions. And with that, I will introduce our guest. We have Josh Young. He's CIO and founder of Bison Interest Energy Fund. Josh has built his career concentrating on deep value opportunities for investors. He has over 15 years experience in investment management, 10 of which were focused on publicly traded oil and gas securities. Josh was management consultant to Fortune 500 companies and private equity firms, and then an investment analyst at a private equity fund. He worked as an energy investment analyst for a multi-billion dollar single family office and was nominated as Institutional Investor Single Family Office of the Year in 2008. We have Vandana Hari. She is a founder and CEO of Vanda Insights, a Singapore-based provider of global oil markets macro analysis. She has 25 years of experience providing intelligence on global energy markets to stakeholders in the petroleum industry, policymakers, and wealth managers. Before launching Vanda Insights in 2016, Vanda served in leadership positions at S&P Global Platts. And last but not least, we have Christine Guerrero. Christine is a petroleum engineer with an MBA. She has nearly two decades within the oil and gas industry, working for Schlumberger, Precision Drilling, Chevron, and Hess Corporation in drilling operations and strategic planning roles prior to becoming a full-time investor and sector advisor. And with that, welcome everybody. We will get started. We do this in a round. But, you know, we can make this as a roundtable as you want. So if you have comments on each other's comments, please, you know, feel free to jump in with your thoughts. And at first, I thought that we would start with Vandana. I wanted to start with Asia, and then we'll move our way to the U.S. and beyond. So let's start with Asia. I'd love your thoughts on the demand situation in China. You know, we've seen slowing of the economy, the housing sector implosion, but we haven't seen all that much of a dent in demand, at least as far as imports are concerned. So is it all stockpiling or other sectors picking up the slack? And what does the demand situation look like going forward?
Yeah, thanks, Tracy. And hello, everyone. Night in Singapore, but good morning, I suppose, for most of our listeners. So in China, yes, very interesting. I am not too optimistic. I wasn't last year either, actually, when a lot of market participants were, especially the first half of last year, were quite bullish about China coming out, you know, with spectacular rebound and recovery. It didn't happen. And one of the reasons I hark back to that is that there are deep-seated structural problems in the Chinese economy, which a lot of them predate COVID, which are going to make it very difficult for the economy to bounce back. Quite a bit of it has to do with demographics, but if you just to look at what happened post-COVID, and of course the longest strict lockdown of any country, any major economy in the world. What we have seen in the first quarter of this year is a mixed macroeconomic data from China. Of course, the first quarter GDP growth came in good, about 5%. But people do take the official GDP data with a pinch of salt. When you sort of pass through all the various macroeconomic numbers, you realize very quickly that the momentum was driven by infrastructure investment and growth in the manufacturing sector. Now, both of these very clearly are not sustainable in the long run, and they're certainly not going to, you know, kickstart the economic growth or the oil demand into a much higher gear. The property market still remains in the doldrums. I talked to a lot of people, again, based here in Singapore, other parts of Asia, who went back to China for longer periods to sort of reconnect with family, friends, and clients. And, you know, they tell me the mood on the ground is very somber. The consumer confidence is very low. A lot of that has to do with the very weak property market. So we saw Chinese oil demand growth of probably somewhere around 700,000-800,000 barrels per day year on year last year in 23. I do believe that that was the majority of the rebound that we were going to see for a long time post-COVID. And this year, probably it'll be closer to half, or, you know, maybe 300,000-400,000 barrels per day year-on-year growth in China. So it is continuing to recover, but it's going to be a sluggish recovery. And we're going to see a lessening pace of demand rebound than what we did see in 23.
Are we seeing any bright spots in PAC Asia, say Vietnam, Taiwan?
So before I go to the Southeast Asian economies, a quick word on India. You did mention that as well, Tracy. So quite a contrast, actually, I would say, between China and India. India is doing very well. The economy, there's been, again, a lot of infrastructure spending by the Modi government. And that, you know, it's driven the economic growth. It's also driven in itself, when you there's a lot of infrastructure being built, that also spurs oil demand. So Indian oil demand growth is quite strong for that, you know, historically looking at that country, more than 5% year-on-year growth. But something to bear in mind, you know, people tend to talk about China, India oil consumption in the same breath. Something worth bearing in mind is that India consumes less than a third of what China consumes. So Indian oil demand is just over about 5 million barrels per day. So even at 5% year-on-year growth, you know, in absolute terms, you're just getting about maybe 250,000-300,000 barrels per day addition in terms of consumption. Southeast Asian economies are doing well. The bigger ones, Indonesia and Malaysia, which sort of stand a little bit on their own. The others are far more reliant on China and driven by Chinese economic growth, trade with China. Those, you know, like Vietnam and Thailand, not so much. One of the areas I would keep a close eye on is the sort of backlash that China is now facing in terms of clean energy exports. It's the, you know, tariffs and so on from EU as well as from the US. We had news just yesterday of US imposing 100% tariffs on Chinese EVs. And the reason and the connection with the Southeast Asian economies is that, as I said, these sort of piggyback quite a bit on Chinese economy. Some of them have also been used as sort of to redirect. So the exports happen via those countries, but are actually coming from China. But if, as a sort of next stage, if those get clamped down upon, then these economies would suffer in addition to China as well.
Thank you. And I want to get into the tariffs a little bit, but first let's move over to the United States really quickly, and we'll come back to that because I do want to get into that a little bit more. Christine, I wanted to talk to you. I wanted to talk about EIA data because it seems there's been kind of a deterioration of the data for quite a few months now. And recently you reported a discrepancy you found between Texas Railroad Company and EIA data for Texas. So can you dig into this and what you found?
Yeah, thanks, Tracy. So, you know, first of all, I started out my career as a drilling engineer. So I am very focused on the drill bit, especially in the US, where, you know, a large, you know, majority of our production now is short cycle production. So wells come online, they peak out within a few months, and then they start exponentially declining. This essentially means that we've constantly got to be turning over our wells and replacing them with new wells to keep from falling off. And so what I saw as I've been tracking the data was that well completions for Texas and for the US essentially peaked in March of last year, more than a year ago now. And since March of last year, well completions for Texas are down about 20%. And overall for the U.S., they're down 22%. I mean, that is a huge decline in wells that are being turned on month over month. And yet we really haven't seen the EIA pivot from this growth trajectory that they have for U.S. production. So you know, they've got us more or less moving along, you know, at 13.1 million, you know, barrels per day. I mean, they did pull back slightly from November, December last year, when I think they got up to like 13.2 or something like that. But they definitely haven't shown, you know, a significant decline from these peak rates, even though the infield activity isn't there. And so, you know, ever since the end of last year, I've been like looking for these declines. And they just haven't come from the EIA. So then I started basically drilling in to the sources of these data. And you know, ultimately the EIA is collecting information from the various states. And I'm lazy, so I only looked at Texas, because Texas is like 42% of US production. So I went and I queried the state level data for production, and there is a huge divergence between what Texas is reporting for state production and what the EIA is reporting for state production. And if you go to my feed 6 minutes ago, I had shared a chart, and it gives you the 914 survey, which is a survey of producers that the EIA puts out, and they get basically like, they say that this survey encompasses 90% of the production within the U.S., and producers are required to fill out this form and submit it to the EIA within 40 days of the end of the month. So you can see those results on that chart, which is the blue line, the 914 survey. And historically, the EIA has always, for Texas, added almost another, you know, 200,000 to maybe even 500,000 of barrels to per day to come up with what they give us as their EIA monthly number. And if you assume that 90% of the production is being reported in this survey, and if you just simply extrapolate out that you would add 10% of onto that number for the producers that aren't being gathered, those really small producers, then maybe you start to derive at the EIA monthly number, which is being presented. But like that survey is 500 producers nationwide. So let's just cut that number in half and say that it's 250 of Texas's largest producers. And like, I believe that number is probably higher than 90% of Texas's production. So I kind of feel like the EIA was kind of already over padding that number to come up with their monthly number. But another source of data that feeds into their monthly, in addition to the 914 survey, is the light blue line, the Enverus data. And so you can see that Enverus actually tracks really closely with the Texas Railroad Commission data in green. And they should, because Enverus is mostly is a suppository of a collection point for level data, and as well as operator reported data that they're getting. And they're going back and they're adjusting their lines historically. So there's kind of always going to be a lag. But anyway, you can see that even Enverus versus the EIA monthly data that we're given in our monthly reports, like they start to diverge in like April, May of last year. And it makes absolutely no sense that the EIA should be giving a number that's even more bullish than the Enverus number is, when the survey of the largest producers is also showing that, you know, there's this error band. And so, and I'm probably all over the place, and a lot of people are probably having a hard time following me. But again, like when we think about operationally what's occurring, in March of last year, more than a year ago, producers started dropping frac crews and started completing less wells. And those producers that were doing that were mostly the marginal producers that were being priced out because oil dropped into the 60s last year multiple times. And so those producers haven't come back. And then we've even seen larger producers start to drop a frac crew and whatnot, because like I've also spoke about in other podcasts, like the pipeline capacity for the Permian is pretty much choked out for natural gas. So there's a number of producers that are having to pay extreme fees this past month if they're going to try to produce more oil because there's no takeaway for their natural gas. So these are all things that operationally should be slowing down production. And yet we're not seeing that yet from what the EIA is reporting. But the largest divergence is on the EIA monthly to what's actually in the Texas Railroad Commission, you know, their survey of operators, which, you know, and verbatim, like I emailed the Texas Railroad Commission and they came back and what they told me verbatim was, we are the regulatory agency for oil and gas production. The numbers we have reported should be the most accurate of any reporting agency or company. And even though they said that, like if we go back and we compare their information to what is in the EIA monthly report for June of 2023, there is almost a 233,000 barrel per day difference on what the Texas Railroad Commission has and what the EIA is telling us. And that difference grows to 539,000 barrels per day by the end of the year in December of 2023. And they've been like, both of these agencies, I've been emailing them this week and they've been responding back. And the EIA, like their pushback is like, oh, there's a reporting lag, you know, there's a reporting lag. And I'm like, the reporting lag isn't a year for the largest, you know, the largest oil producing state in the U.S. I mean, I'm really scratching my head. Like, and I've been emailing these guys charts. I've been presenting their own data back to them because I'm like the well completions, that trend of well completions should somewhat follow the trend of production. If you see well completions climbing, you would expect that within a few months, the production would climb accordingly. And the same way when it declines. And even though there's been some longer laterals being turned on, and maybe wells, because they have these longer laterals, are producing, you know, 10% or 15% more volume. I mean, when you think about this, like this longer laterals didn't just happen overnight. Like they've been occurring for years. So when we look at like 6 month tranches, when we look at what's been done over the past 6 months versus what happened in this 6 months a year ago, there shouldn't be like a 20% difference in well efficiency. And that's why I just keep, you know, like that, go basically going out of my way to email these agencies so they look harder at their data and their reporting and figure out, you know, who's wrong. I mean, maybe the Texas Railroad Commission needs to come up a little bit, but I definitely believe that the EIA needs to come down.
It's not surprising to me. Again, I think their data in general has been deteriorating for well over a year, at least. And have you looked at the demand side? Because it seems like EIA has been consistently understating demand and overstating production.
I mean, there's probably somebody better to speak to the demand than I am, so I'm just not even going to go there. Like, I, I mean, we keep getting these headline reports that demand is weak, but then at the same time, we also get other indicators from, like, for instance, you know, Gas Buddy, who said that I think last week we had the second highest, you know, a gasoline requirement of the year. So, I mean, as you know, like, we're in shoulder season now. Demand doesn't tend to really ramp up until after Memorial Day, which is just a couple months away. So for me to believe that demand is low right now, I mean, like I want to see data that says the demand is low once Memorial Day hits, because I think that that's like the where the rubber hits the road area.
Absolutely, that makes sense. And then you know, you touched on like lateral efficiencies a little bit, and I was going to ask you about that. But you know, if you look at production plus duct drain plus if lateral efficiencies that have been kind of baked in, it does seem like things aren't exactly adding up at all.
I mean, people like so many people that are looking closely at this data, I mean, we're all confounded and we literally give ourselves headaches trying to figure out what's going on, because it doesn't make sense. I mean, like, I almost feel like I'm being gaslighted by the EIA, because I'm like, these production, you know, curves that you're presenting us, I mean, they're just not following, you know, what's occurring within the operational realm, which is more important now than ever because of short cycle. And even on that EIA survey. So like I said, that 914 survey, like when they first launched that survey almost a decade ago, you know, at that point in time, shale was a much smaller percentage of the production than it is today. And they basically said, every month we're going to pull the 500 largest operators in the U.S. And those 500 operators are going to give us a picture of what 90% of the U.S. production is. And, you know, honestly, like, that's fine. And that they did that, and that they were basically each month kind of averaging what that other 10% was doing. But also when I looked at the specific data, how much additional production they are adding to the survey data to come up with their monthly numbers, like in some months it's 15%. It makes no sense that you would be juicing the survey data by an incremental 15%. I mean, like, effectively what they're saying is that the marginal producers were now producing disproportionately to what majors are saying. And so like the basically just the sense check on a lot of these curves. I mean, in my mind, it's just not it's not passing the logic check. And maybe no one's even doing that anymore, because this has all been you know, algorized. I wonder, how many people are actually looking at these curves being presented and are saying, does this make sense? Does this make sense? Does this make sense? Because the observers like myself, for months now, we've been saying it doesn't. And yet the EIA still hasn't really pivoted.
Jeff, I'd like you to jump in on this, because I know we've had several conversations on the EIA data. So, you know, if you have anything to add to that as well, you know, I'd like to get your thoughts.
Yeah, sure. So first of all, on the China was mentioned previously, and I think there was sort of this extreme in terms of sentiment and forecasting for China and India at the start of this year, where everyone was incredibly bullish on India and everyone was incredibly bearish on China. And I think I remember listening to a panel of three different China experts. I can't remember if it was on a Twitter space or a podcast, but, you know, really legitimate very focused just on China, and they were all very, very bearish coming into this year. And it does seem, you know, the Chinese economic statistics are maybe even worse than the EIA and US statistics. Even ignoring their statistics and just looking at sort of the raw materials they're consuming, like oil, and then sort of other alternative ways to triangulate, it does actually seem like they're economy is less bad than people had thought, and their oil demand growth this year is actually surprising to the upside, again from very, very low levels. So I thought I'd just mention that. And then in terms of the EIA, I think like the thing that matters. So I think I mostly agree with what Christine was saying. I think it's important to step back and say, hey, like what's actually like, why does this matter if we're really producing, let's say, 12.9 million barrels a day and not 13.2 or something like the EIA was saying? And it's that there's, I think it's something like 6 or 7 million barrels a day of oil production from shale that grew over the last decade or decade and a half. And that was basically almost the entire global incremental supply. And is what sort of crashed the oil market in 2014 and sort of kept oil prices way lower than the historical trend and way lower than, various other similar sort of products and way below sort of long-term trend inflation and so on. So I think the important thing is that if shale production has started to roll over, which it seems like there's a lot of evidence of, from some of the stuff Christine was saying, and then also just frankly the rig count being down, you would expect production to be down a lot and maybe see production fall even more. As that happens, you have this incremental source of supply of oil falling off, and that's very bullish. Again, there's sort of this base expectation of shale production growth. And if it requires $80+ oil to get back to shale production growth, or $90+ oil, and maybe also, let's say, $3 per MCF or $4 per MCF natural gas instead of two, like we've seen for the last roughly, 6 months or so, and with a negative trajectory, that has real global oil market implications, and again, sort of resets arguably the floor price for oil a lot higher. So I think that's why it matters. I think what Christine is saying is right for the most part, and I think it's important just to understand why it's so important. It's not necessarily that the EIA statistics on their own matter, and there are offsetting factors that affect actual inventories and crack spreads and so on that affect sort of the physical market. I think it's more for forecasting and understanding the inflection that's already happened, and I think that's why it's just so important, understanding how much production came from shale, how much people are still expecting it to come from shale, and how little incremental production. Again, we actually may have seen production decreases net of weather effects and other from shale this year, which is very far off. I think I can't remember if it was EIA or IEA, but they had sort of this consensus expectation of roughly, I think, 500,000 barrels a day of oil production growth in the U.S., essentially from shale. And so, a decrease instead of that is a very, very significant change.
And what are your thoughts on if we add in kind of sentiment, right? Because we've just seen, we kind of had that kick up on geopolitical risk. And then since oil has sold off, and since then, we've kind of seen, if you look at the CFTC data, we've seen kind of funds, money managers pull out of the market, and we're, almost to the lows again, which kind of seems it's an opportunity for me. But, how much do you count on sentiment when you're kind of analyzing these markets, when you have, when you're thinking, oil should, looking at all of the fundamental data, oil probably should be a little bit higher, but yet everybody's dumping oil contracts. So how big of a factor do you look at when you're looking at kind of that data?
So I think it matters a little. I think actually the thing that maybe matters more than that is looking at how much the price moves versus how much positioning has moved, because I think that sort of tells you how tight or loose the physical market is, as well as the conviction in the move. So positioning can affect price in different ways. So the positioning fall in 2020, you know, sent oil prices negative from, what was it, $70 or something WTI in January 2020 to negative in April 2020. A similar shift down in positioning, not as extreme, but similar, recently sent oil down $7. So, and again, that's like the 2020 example is the most extreme, but I think it helps to sort of highlight how different price movements can be with similar changes in positioning. And if you look back, you know, I would have thought there would have been closer to, let's say, a $15 or $20 price move for this change in positioning from, it looked like it was what, like 70 or 80% or something of the all-time highs or whatever for positioning a few weeks ago. And now we were down, I think the low point was, it looks like 20%. These are using Goldman Sachs numbers I had posted. I can put them up in the Nest. So again, very, very significant change in positioning, very small comparatively move in price. And to me, that actually maybe matters more. And obviously it tells you sentiment is very weak, but also that maybe the fair price for oil, you know, if you got back to, let's say, that 50% positioning, which it's not a perfect thing, but maybe you'd see oil back up another $10 or so, and maybe that would be closer to sort of fair value in today's market, even with crack spreads in the 20s and not the 30s, which again, that's like the refining margin. It's sort of a good proxy for how much real demand there is versus refinery supply today.
And we've seen those crack spreads have come off quite a bit. Do you think that's actually a demand factor?
No, I think it's actually been really odd to see. So I was pretty negative on crack spreads for most of the last 3 years because there were a huge number of refineries that were coming out of sort of care and maintenance during COVID at very low utilization levels. And then there were a number of new refineries being built internationally, including in, I think the most recent one was the Dangote one in Nigeria. And then there was one, I can't remember if it was Kuwait or somewhere similar. And so you had a number of different refineries coming on with substantial capacity. And, you know, when refining margins got to 70 or something around the Russian invasion, that to me seemed like a huge overreach. And if you look at the history of crack spreads over the last, let's say, 10 years, you know, 20 plus dollars a barrel, essentially refining margin, on a gross basis is great for a refinery. The refiners, for the most part, other than the highest cost ones, actually make a lot of money at that price. And so I think people just needed to recalibrate down. And then the ironic thing is, I'm actually pretty bullish on refiners from here, or at least on refining margins, because now that we have utilization way back up and we have these new refineries mostly working, there's not the next big refinery coming on that I can see, at least with, let's say, a million or more barrels a day of refining capacity, at least outside of China. And so, you know, I think we actually could end up with a little bit of refining shortage, but also, you know, to directly answer the question, the crack spread doesn't always tell you physical demand. It tells you physical demand versus refining capacity. And with utilization having ticked up so much so quickly in the last few weeks, you would have expected their crack spread to fall. And again, similar to the positioning thing, how much did the crack spread fall versus how much did utilization rise? And we're not quite at a seasonally strong area yet for demand. We're a little lower for gasoline in the US so far this year versus last year, but last year was very, very strong at this time of year. And you know, I think, again, it's just helpful to have context. And in that context, these refining margins actually look quite good to me. And global demand actually looks quite robust. Again, getting me to that, you know, sort of shot in the dark, hey, maybe oil should be 85 or 90 here, just at current supply and demand levels and at current refining capacity, and tracking sort of current consumption and consumption trends.
I forgot to unmute myself. And we'll come back to you because I'm not done with the United States and I want to dig into a little bit of Canada with you in a bit. I want to go back to Vandana. I want to talk about these China tariffs that the U.S. just enacted. What, if any, do you think will be their retaliation? And, you know, will that affect the energy markets? Will they stop exports or even agriculture markets?
Yeah, so it's very interesting. The trade war between China and U.S. has been going on for a few years now, and this just takes it to yet another level. It's going to be difficult for China, not just because of the US tariffs, but it's facing very similar pushback on a few other fronts as well. So we know solar panel exports, of course, it's a major producer, batteries that go into EV. China has a very strong hold on the graphite market as well, which go into these batteries. And it's as a result, it just seems to have triggered quite a lot of just a storm of concerns in the EU as well. So we'll have to see what the EU does now, because what the EU was looking at was, you know, compared to what the US has done, raising the tariffs on EVs to 100%, what the EU was contemplating was far milder. And, you know, one wonders if now the EU will be sort of feel that they have to come up with something much stronger in retaliation as well. You know, all in, Tracy, I just find this I think it's a huge paradox in general. You know, if you just take a few steps back and think of, you know, what's happening globally. We're trying to replace an energy system that was established over decades. And yes, it has had its own issues, you know, civil strife and what have you, sanctions and against countries. We've had we've had wars, but by and large, you know, the reason oil and gas developed and we have these fungible, very very reliable markets, energy system today, is that we didn't have the kind of trade protectionism and trade wars. You know, at certainly nothing as ferocious as what we are seeing today. So, you know, I just find this sort of hugely ironical that, yes, it's a dilemma as well, because I understand that the EU and the US want to encourage their domestic industries, clean energy industries, but, you know, they're going to say, they are here in a position, they're saying no to huge, massive exports, and ready now, right? These products, China's ready to flood these markets with products now. So if you want to accelerate your green energy transition, and here I'm talking about the Western world, and you want to do it economically, which is also tick, tick, yes, both, right? You would want to do it economically also, because you don't want to start fueling inflation again. All those reasons would have one thing that the West would say yes to these, at least for the time being, right? And find ways to allow their clean industries to develop as well. But I'm just personally quite surprised and shocked, but at the sort of how strong the backlash against the trade protectionism is, and the backlash against China is. So at this point, Tracy, it's really hard to say what China might do, because, you know, where does it end? Tit for tat tariffs. And as it is, you know, China is a major exporter. It's not an importer, huge net importer from the West, from the US or the EU. So, you know, there's only so much it can gain or retaliate by coming up with tit for tat. Tariffs, you know, the one obvious solution for China would be to start looking at other markets. And maybe start is not the right word. It is flooding its cars into Asia as well. You know, we see the BYD Chinese EV cars here in Singapore as well. We've been seeing them since last year, you know, quite prominently. They're making their way into India as well. So I think what China will probably do is try and find, so retaliation is one thing, right? But the other more important step for China would be to try, because it has this huge capacity. It is over capacity in all these clean energy products that I mentioned. It cannot afford to let its manufacturing start shriveling again. You know, I mentioned earlier that manufacturing boost was a major driver of momentum in the first quarter and the first 4 months of this year. So it'll look at other markets. It'll probably drop prices even further to push more of its car sales into these markets. And, you know, let's see what comes out of Europe. We had Xi Jinping touring Europe, I believe it was last week. I'm sure he's, you know, he's probably given up hope on trying to reconcile on the trade front with the US, but maybe China will try and find some ways of sort of making it work with the EU. So I think that remains to be seen. But overall, you know, just going back to the point I've made earlier, this is the manufacturing momentum that we saw for various reasons, so not just clean energy products, but in general, the export markets of China are not doing that well. So that in turn feeds into lower oil demand growth in China. And, you know, we listened to analysts from the state-owned oil giants in China, you know, CNPC, for instance, and Sinopec. And, you know, it's almost like they were singing from the same hymn sheet, all of them. And this is not this year or last year. You know, in recent years, they've all been saying that Chinese oil demand peak is within sight. You know, they're saying gasoline demand probably peaking this year or next year, distillate demand as well. So you have to keep in mind that the diesel demand in China is driven by the property sector and the manufacturing sector. So both for diesel and gasoline, it's not looking very good. Both of these products are expected to hit peak demand in China in the next 2, maximum 3 years. That essentially just leaves you with NAFTA. And yes, NAFTA consumption is expected to continue rising. China has done a lot of downstream integration of its refining sector. So it is moving more into specialty chemicals as well. So petrochemicals is a huge push. So NAFTA demand will continue to rise. But again, you have to bear in mind, where does that NAFTA and the petrochemicals feed into, you know, various kinds of plastics and petrochemicals that, again, go into end-user products, which brings you back to exports. So, you know, if China's exports markets, namely the West, don't recover, then it's going to be in a tough spot. But all in, Chinese oil demand is probably going to peak before the end of this decade.
And since you brought up other markets for China, obviously, since the Ukraine war, we've seen kind of China and Russia grow a little bit closer. So how much of the slack is Russia picking up, if any?
So in trade terms, and, you know, I'm not really an expert on that front. So if you're saying or if you're asking, could Russia be the natural sink for Chinese product exports, like, you know, take the place of EU or the US, I don't think so. But yes, China and Russia have ended up coming quite close together because of, and they were even before Ukraine, but definitely Ukraine has pushed them closer together. Putin is visiting China this week. And, you know, it's more what Russia wants from China. It's quite an asymmetric power relationship now. You know, Russia is not in the sort of same level as it was as a trading partner with China pre-Ukraine. So, you know, Russia is very much looking forward to not just continuing to sell its crude into China, which it will, you know, as long as it's giving a good discount. India as well as China will continue to buy Russian crude. But I think for Russia, the bigger concern now is finding a market for its natural gas, which has been locked out of Europe. And, you know, there's only two ways to do it. Either you set up, you put up more LNG liquefaction facility, which Russia is doing. But as you've seen, you know, it's the Arctic LNG 2 project. It is going to face delays and, you know, funding problems and access to technology and so on. So for Russia, an easier route would be to lay more pipelines, increase the capacity of, increase the flows of pipeline natural gas into China. And so this is where China really holds the trump card, you know, because Russia can't really, wouldn't be able to put a pipeline to any other major consuming country like it can to China. So that's the kind of relationship between those two countries for the time being.
Thank you. And now I want to go back to Christine. I want to talk about, I know you follow offshore markets quite a bit. So I kind of wanted to talk about that. First, in the United States, are we worried because the Biden administration is not really issuing permits anymore? and then, you know, are there better opportunities in South America or Africa?
Well, so the permitting situation is kind of what makes the next presidential election important, because Biden has significantly slowed down the number of lease sales that are occurring for the Gulf of Mexico. And so, I mean, pretty much leases that are held under production are good, but, you know, just like with any oil field, you have to constantly be stretching out and exploring unexplored areas to try to backfill, you know, production in the years ahead. And there used to be multiple lease sales a year, but now under the Biden administration, they've really slowed down those sales. And so there's concern there. And nothing is expected to change if Biden gets reelected, but the consensus is pretty much that, you know, if leadership in the White House changes, then the lease sales would, you know, return to status quo. You know, but the thing about the Gulf of Mexico is, I mean, it is 40 or 50 years old, you know, in terms of production. And so the shallower areas are, you know, pretty much pick through. Like actually, when you look at the production for the Gulf of Mexico, you know, it appears to be declining, but really it's only declining in the shallower areas. The deeper water is actually growing. And a lot of that is the Paleogene, which requires, I mean, they're basically ultra high pressure wells. And so it does look like there's going to be a number of developments that come online in the years ahead. You know, they're requiring 8th generation rigs and 20 to 25,000 PSI, you know, BOP stacks and like leading edge technology. I mean, I used to tell people, you know, because a lot of people consider oil and gas like low tech. And I'm like, not if you're in the deep water environment. I'm like, if for deep water, the technology, you know, competes with, you know, with deep space. I mean, it's like I even recruited someone who, you know, back when I used to work in operations, who, I mean, his job offers were oil field and NASA. So because you have the meteorology, you know, has to be so precise. I mean, you're dealing with extreme pressures and extreme temperatures. And so it is really high tech. But those same, the Gulf of Mexico has kind of always been the birthplace of oil field technology. And so, you know, as things were developed, it gets rolled out to other regions around the world. So when you look at oil field, you know, production growth, I do believe that other basins, you know, are, you know, globally are going to deliver more volumes, you know, in the decades ahead than the Gulf of Mexico, just because of it being a mature basin versus a maturing basin. I mean, you know, Brazil doesn't show any signs of slowing down. You know, Guyana, Suriname doesn't show any signs of slowing down. You know, now everyone's also looking to Namibia. I mean, there hasn't been a project sanctioned yet, but there's been a number of discoveries. So, I mean, it's expected that eventually you'll start seeing some projects being sanctioned over there. But the other thing that we're seeing is, you know, in today's cost environment, like, you know, 10, 15 years ago, if you had a small field, you might be able to turn on a field that's only like 150,000 barrel field. But nowadays, it seems like the focus is on much more like these massive developments that are going to pump, you know, 200,000 barrels per day. And so the scale of the projects are getting much, much larger. And so deep water, you know, it's gonna continue to be like land of the giants and land of the majors. because if you're looking at the facilities that can handle 20,000 or 200,000 barrels per day, I mean, you're looking at facilities that might cost, you know, $8 to $10 billion to build and to build out before a project comes online. But I mean, it is very interesting. I mean, I do believe that in the years ahead, it's not going to be just shale or just deep water. I mean, it's definitely going to be like an all hands on deck approach, because eventually the Permian is going to roll over. Maybe it's rolling over right now. I mean, we still don't have the data like confirming it for multiple agencies. But when the Permian does roll over, I mean, like, in my opinion, that's going to be the shot that gets heard around the world, because ever since the, the shale boom, the markets have become complacent when it comes to oil and gas investing. I mean, that's why you always hear it's a trade, it's not an investment. You know, that's why the market cap for the sector has gone from being 10 or 15% of the S&P down to being 3 or 5. There's this complacency that we're always going to be able to readily turn on more barrels from short cycle. And the moment that the largest oil field in the world can no longer scale higher, that's going to be the aha, oh shit moment. And I believe investors are going to say, you know what, like, these companies should be much higher, the ones with a significant reserves runway, because now you're going to start potentially getting into supply demand imbalances in the years ahead.
That's excellent information. And I want to move over to Josh. First, I want to talk about Canada, but first, I want to talk about the U.S. nat gas market, right? Because we've been, you know, on the floor for months and months and months. It hasn't moved. It looks like Freeport finally has all cars running for the first time in 4 months. You know, is this the thing that, you know, helped lift prices a little bit? And what are your thoughts on the Biden export pause? Because I know it doesn't really matter till 2026, as projects are already permitted and will still go through, but we still have some big projects that are now on hold. So what does this mean for the market?
Yeah, I think, I was pretty bearish gas the last couple of years until recently, just sort of below $2 an MCF was pretty interesting. And even though you would have thought rig counts would have gone even down even more in response to that gas price, You still had a pretty healthy decline in the gas rig count. The various issues at Freeport and other LNG export facilities, I think, just sort of speak to a more realistic expectation of, let's say, 90% uptime on these LNG facilities instead of 99%, like I think a lot of people expected. And so that just means you need even more of these facilities on to sustain the level of exports that people were expecting, and maybe that the global market expects. $2 or $2.20 or whatever it is in MCF right now is clearly unsustainable, to the point where the forward curve is, a dollar plus higher than that. And I think the real debate is,